what you think of the show. My guests all this hour are both debuting on the show as well. They're involved in a brand new show called Rules of Seconds. The playwright is here and also one of the actors in the show who may or may not be married to the playwright. Please welcome to the show for the very first time the wonderful Jennifer Pallone and John Pallone. Welcome, both of you. How are you?
Good.
How good.
You
doing? Thanks
it's good
for
to
having
have you here. I love stories where creative people love each other and work together. I think it's the best LA story there is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been pretty good for about 13 years now.
Isn't that great? Why is it very LA, John?
Well, because we met in LA. We met in an acting class.
Okay.
And started a theater company together. And
yeah. I love that. Are you doing this through your theater company?
Yeah, a lot of people, this one specifically is not.
Okay.
We started a theater company that was really small. We did that for a couple of years. Had a baby.
Yeah. And it's like another theater company.
It was. She's in the business too. And then we took that theater company and it kind of got folded into a bigger one called Rogue Machine Theater.
Sure.
Which we are part of. This is not a Rogue Machine production. Okay. However, a lot of people involved in the production we met through that.
That's wonderful.
It's sort of a new endeavor.
Now, you met out here. Where are you both from? Jennifer, where are you from?
I grew up in Dallas, Texas.
Okay.
And I moved here when I was 18 to go to school.
Okay. For acting?
For acting.
Okay.
I went to American Academy
of
Dramatic Arts.
So you knew you wanted to be an actor?
I did. I grew up doing theater in Dallas.
Okay.
Like,
which actually has a great local theater scene, right?
It does.
It's wonderful.
It has a wonderful, wonderful theater.
And you came here to go to American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
I did.
Which is the LA version.
The LA version.
Is amazing. And then, John, where are you from?
I'm from New Hampshire.
Okay.
I did not go to school for acting or writing or anything like that. I went to University of New Hampshire. And then I went to NYU for a summer.
Okay.
Took a filmmaking course.
Okay. And what was your undergrad and what were you going to do at University of New Hampshire?
I got a dual major in communications and English.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I sort of went to the state school, the school that was on sale.
Okay.
It was a good school.
I did that too.
Yeah.
What did you think that you were going to be with your communications and English?
Yeah, I mean, look, man, I wanted to go to film school. I just couldn't. We couldn't afford it.
Okay.
And I was too kind of scared. I'm not allowed to swear because this is the
right. It's all right if you swear. It's not. I'll get another show. It's all right. No, it's fine. It's really okay.
Oh, for real?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's all right.
I was going to say.
Don't swear a lot.
Yeah.
I was being kind of a pussy because.
Oh, that's not really swearing.
I knew what I was going to. It was going to be much worse. I knew what I wanted to do, but I was kind of afraid to do it. I just didn't have the confidence and enough to really take a risk. And then I went to NYU for the summer. I took a summer-long filmmaking class to sort of dip my toe into it. I had a landscaping lawn mowing business and sort of to pay out. I mean, I still had student loans, but to get through it, and I just mowed extra lawns and bought this, summer package. And then I lived there for the summer, and it was terrifying at first, but it ended up being a life-changing experience because the first time I was around other creative types, I just definitely did not grow up in an area that really nurtured that.
I was going to ask you that. That was my next question. I was going to let you finish, and I was going to ask you, but you just answered your question. If there was anybody from your family in the business, because I could kind of feel there wasn't.
Yeah, they're not. I mean, no, I think my dad was really good at drawing and stuff, and I think that's about the extent of the artistic stuff.
It's hard when there's nobody in your family in the business. It's hard sometimes to tell your parents that it's what you want to be, because this is not a country that so encourages the arts.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of considered like you want to be. I remember when I was a kid, my mom saying to me once, I don't know how old I was in elementary school, and she said, look, if you ever wind up on drugs or you get pregnant, I mean, I was probably 9, just don't run away. Just come and talk to me. Just tell me everything. And I was sort of like, I want to be an actor. I just purged it out. Like, well, if it's okay to get pregnant, it's okay to be an actor. And she was great about it. But my dad, I tell this story all the time, my dad, until the day he died, was like, so someday you're going to go to Caltech and become an engineer like me, right? And I'm like, yes, I'm going to go to Caltech in my 40s, which you could do.
Sure.
But he just did not, it always seemed like something you did temporarily.
Right.
Until you found your real calling, which for him was, of course, being an engineer.
Well, I think that's smart to have, again, certainly in a pragmatic New England environment I grew up in.
Very pragmatic New England. Yes, you are.
Have like a backup, like, what do you want to do? But right. I remember my dad who, he was an engineer. He grew up single mom in Queens. He's Italian. They came over in the boat and all that stuff. And he just didn't have a lot. He became an engineer. And he always said to me that he always wished he could have gone into NASA. and either been an astronaut or worked on the space program. And he didn't because it was really hard to do, and he wanted to make money and have a family and have stability. And he always just told me growing up, he's like, you know, do what you want to do. Find out what you want to do, what you love to do.
Yeah, that's how my mom was,
too. And do that. Yeah. He just didn't know how to get me there. And certainly, but that's like you're saying, is like when you have that model in front of you, somebody who makes a living doing it, it's really makes all the difference in the world. It took me a long ass time to figure out
how to make a living. And my dad's also an engineer, I told you. So we have, and also from Queens.
Oh, there you go.
Look
that
at
right?
that. Yeah, and I'm from New England. Well, New Haven. So so the outskirts of New England.
Right.
Where New York Metro meets New England. End of New England.
When I was a kid, we didn't even believe Connecticut was part of New England.
I know.
Drove through it,
I know. I believe Connecticut is because there's the Pepperidge Farm part of Connecticut, like where everybody kind of talks like the Pepperidge Farm man.
Yeah.
But New Haven's not part of that. New Haven's like an angry shipping town. It's like part of New York that broke off and sailed across
but
the Sound.
Angry shipping town sounds very New England to me.
See, to me that sounds very New York.
Yeah.
I think
maybe it's just the angry part.
Oh, that's but you do have, John, kind of a cold weather demeanor.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, you have a very New England demeanor.
Yeah, I mean, that's
I mean, because like Jennifer's over there, she's all smiling, and look, I grew up in a place where the sun shines a lot, and you kind of have that like
she's
kind of personality.
Well, don't let her fool you because she's a very dark person.
But she would do her dark with a smile, like
an
bless your heart kind of darkness.
No, yes. she is. Yes, yeah. She's got that southern, and I'll let her speak because she's here. But she has that southern manners that
I definitely don't
have, where people come over and she's like, oh, the house has to look nice. You have to have the right kind of foods for them and all that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I just give you a beer and you can have a seat and you're fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's pretty good with anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm the same way, that kind of New England-y thing where I'm like, just bring over whatever you want.
Yeah.
Just eat it on my couch. It's fine. So Jennifer, what about you? When did you know you wanted to be an actress?
You know, I started doing children's theater at Dallas Children's Theater when I was 7.
Wow. Okay.
And I think I performed in my first official play there at 8 or 9.
Okay.
And I just knew the second I did it that I wanted to do it. But I had a mother who was like, yay, go do it.
Yeah. Yeah,
not
mine too.
Not a stage mom, but like
no,
a,
that's creepy.
Yeah. Just like a really like, oh, this is it. This is your thing. This is, and grandparents who were very supportive of it too. So, I mean, I constantly did like outside theater when I was in school, and in high school I was always doing productions like through like Garland Civic and in downtown Dallas. And
it's wonderful though. I think that for kids that did and I didn't do as much, but did a lot of acting outside of academia, outside of high school, college, grade school, you can learn a lot more how the business works. I think you kind of have a leg up. Because you learn a lot more about... You're very insulated still while you're in the academic environment. You know, you're doing the plays and hopefully your acting teachers are trying to teach you how the business works. But you're not really in the business. But if you're out doing repertory theater and children's theater and even to a lesser degree community theater, you're out in where people are trying to make a living at it and you're learning a lot more.
Right. And Dallas does have a, it has a pretty good commercial market and voiceover market. So there was that there. But I pretty much did theater my childhood. I didn't learn about TV or film or anything really until I came out here.
Do you miss theater? If you could not do it, if you were so busy with TV and film that you couldn't do theater for a year, would you be dying to get back on stage?
Yes, probably. Well, I just
she had
I
to
do
really hesitate.
I do so much theater, that I need to.
You need
stop.
To miss it a little bit.
I need to miss it a lot. Yeah.
Okay.
And then we just this play. It was like 4 weeks of intense rehearsal. So I think I'm good this year. Theater.
So because I get so busy with radio, and every once in a while I think, God, I need to do a play.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it does gnaw at you till you do one.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine if you're on a TV show and during the summers you're doing a movie, and so you're so busy, you just want to get back on that stage. So bad,
no, I mean, I'm sure I would admit, because I would say in the last 5 years I've probably done 6 plays, 7 plays,
good for
something
you.
Like that.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I went on quite a little roll there, but.
All through Rogue Machine? Or through people you knew from Rogue Machine?
Rogue Machine, and then, people that had seen me and things at Rogue Machine that wanted me to. PRT, Pacific Residence Theater in Venice.
Sure.
We have a lot of members in common. So one of the members had written an original piece, and so I went over there.
It's our good buddy, Keith Stevenson. He wrote a play. Jen was pregnant with our son. So she, I don't know if he did it intentionally, but she played a pregnant character, so she was able to act in the play and be pregnant.
Just took it to London over Christmas, and now he's going to go back and do a 5-week run in the West End.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's pretty great.
That's awesome. Isn't that wonderful? And then, so how many times have you guys worked together?
I mean, like I said, when we were in class, I wrote her like little one-act plays. She's such a great actress. Before we started dating, and then,
so I had done a lot of theater, and then John was bringing these little scenes into class because we did a scene study class through Laura Gardner at Howard Fine, and he had been bringing these scenes in, and my friend Michael Rex and I, we had grown up doing a lot of theater, so I was like, John, these are really great. We should rent out a theater space and do them. So that's how the little theater company became sort of a thing.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
And John, when did you start writing?
I mean, I always was kind of like a writer, a shitty writer. still debatable whether or not that's moved on from that. But I always like wrote, you know, short stories and that kind of stuff. I wanted to be Stephen King growing up. That was
God, sure. Didn't we all?
And then
did you write horror?
Yeah, I kind of did. Well, you know what it is? It's like the O. Henry, Stephen King.
Sure. The irony of O. Henry.
Yeah, but it's just
ironic.
Like when you read a story and you're like, damn, that's awesome. It like takes you to another place. Especially when I was younger, I was too immature to really, I mean, maybe I still am. I wanted to kind of have my mind blown and really have twists and, you know, pulpy stuff.
Do you still want that?
Sometimes, yeah. Okay. I mean, I do. I mean, I think the best thing is a combination of the two. And I think that's why I gravitated towards theater and towards film and TV, because you're entertaining at the same time as telling a story. I mean, I think if I don't enjoy theater, that's just really, really deep and profound but doesn't have a story to it. And conversely, if I just watch something that's pure entertainment and doesn't have any balls or guts to it, I don't find that as enjoyable. But
I feel the same way. I don't understand why people just want to watch something that has nothing in it. It's all fluff. I mean, I get that people want to escape. Maybe I just don't want to escape that badly.
I mean, I think there's a time and a place. I mean, look, when I it's certainly not indicative of the type of material I write, but when I get home and I'm, you know, have a beer and the kids are asleep, I'll turn on, you know, the Avengers or something, you know, pulpier. You just don't want to.
That's also pretty angsty. I mean, for pulp, the Avengers is kind
of. Yeah, but you know, like an action movie, or I'll watch something that I've seen like 10 times, as opposed to digging into something really challenging. I have to kind of be in the right mood for that, you know? But, you know, theater's different. I think theater should be, like I said, Stephen King and O. Henry, those guys do, is like they're writers who are really cognizant of their audience, and I think good theater knows the audience and is aware of the reaction you're trying to elicit. You know, like good filmmakers are, or something.
Yeah,
that
I agree.
You feel like there's an authority there, and it's not just there. It's not. I mean, I never get. Sometimes I see plays that just go on and on, and I know that the theme is all up front, but it's just not. It's not engaging to me, and some people like that. That's just not my thing.
It depends. If it's beautifully written, if the dialogue is gorgeous to listen to, I don't mind if there's no edge. And if there's edge, I don't mind if the dialogue's a little more base.
Well, what do you mean by edge?
Well, I don't mind if it's just kind of all sprawled out in front of you, like this is going to be a play where we sit around and discuss our relationship for 2 hours. If the dialogue is fantastic and the words are placed beautifully, I will listen to people sitting around talking about, you know, the same thing for 2 hours.
Sure.
But if it's not, if there's not the words, then I want the plot. I will substitute one for the other. But if there's not either, then I'm bored.
Well, I think in theater you kind of have to have all of that, you know.
You do. You should have both.
For sure.
But not every playwright does.
No.
And we go see a lot of things in this town that our friends are involved in one way or another. And sometimes it's amazing and it knocks you on your butt. But more likely than not, you're thinking of good things to feel about it as you're watching it. Like, I'm really enjoying this 2 hours of my life and being here because.
Well, I think it's interesting to me because in terms of theater is such a courageous endeavor. It's so goddamn hard to do.
As
an actor, as a writer, as everybody is working.
As a producer.
Hard. It's just as hard to create a bad play as it is a good one. That even if I see something and I'm not into it, I'm always blown away by people who have the ball. balls to do that.
I agree.
And it's not, I never feel like I'm truly wasting my time when I watch a play because I just support it and I think it is. And, you know, a lot of times I'll just be like, it's not for me. I don't get it, but somebody else is. And I think it's, you know, so subjective a lot of times. And
yeah, it completely is. Well, all art, right? Why does somebody fall in love with a song and you listen to it and think, eh, all right. I mean, somebody else, it's like, that's my favorite song. Or a TV show, right? That's my favorite ever. And you're like, oh, I saw it and it was okay. But
yeah.
I mean, that's the wonderful thing about art is that it is subjective. You never know whose eyes and ears and soul it's going to land on that are just going to become obsessed with it.
Yeah.
You throw it out there and some people are ravenous about it and some people could care less and most people feel somewhere in the middle there. And
that's hard, though. I think when you create something, you always want everybody to like it and get it. I mean,
it's true.
And I, personally, it's the things I have that have resonated the deepest with people have also bounced completely off other people. And that's sort of a hard lesson to learn. And it's never easy, but that's ultimately, what do you want? Do you want to make, you know, everybody kind of, eh, that's pretty good, or do you want to really nail some people? And some people are like, that's just not my cup of tea. I mean, I intentionally think, everything I do, I think everyone's going to just adore and change their lives.
Having that attitude is a one-up on a lot of people in this business. That's
a
good thing.
It's actually quite the opposite. I'm always like, what the hell are we doing?
So, Jennifer, tell me a little bit about this play and what you love about it.
Well, this one, John's been working on for a long time. I want to say five years?
I mean, on and off. You make it sound like that's...
No, I mean, on and off, in between other projects. But it's a period piece set in 1855 in Boston, Massachusetts. And period piece, but it's very modern in the storytelling. And it's based about... it's about this family who... one of the sons gets challenged to a duel. And... what it means, like, to have to, like, live in a society with codes and rules, and what it means to be a man in that time period, what it means to be a woman. There's two women characters in the play. One is the mother, Martha, who's played by Amy Brenneman, and then I play Hannah, the Irish maid to the evil man.
Oh.
Who, one
the
of the
evil
sons...
Evil man's Irish maid.
The evil man's Irish maid. And then one of the sons just happens to have left her behind a long time ago. So there's a love story that kind of gets involved. But really, it's the central part of the story is about the two brothers and how different they are and how one is a certain version of a man and another is a different version of a man. And they're kind of the polar opposites and what it means to be... to be an actual man.
That's wonderful.
Is what the play's about, I think.
That's pretty good. Okay.
John, what about for you? How did this play sort of start to come to be when it was rolling around your noggin?
Sure. I mean, the majority of the plays that I've written, other than this one, are very naturalistic and sort of slice of life. And the intent is always, the best compliment I ever got on other plays would be like, I forgot I was watching a play.
That's
I
wonderful.
I felt I was eavesdropping. Yeah. This is the most sort of theatrical. And again, I didn't grow up in theater, not unlike Jen. I didn't go to a lot of plays. I sort of was new to it when I started working in theater. But this is a product of a group called the Temblers. I don't know if you were sort of told about that. So Temblers is this new playwright initiative based in L.A., and it's seven different playwrights who really represent the cross-section of L.A. It's a very diverse group. So I got involved with them about a year and a half ago. I had this play... had a couple of workshops with it, always liked it, and then working with them really brought it to a whole other level. So everything that I sort of thought the play was about got amplified by kind of, you know, we because we're a collective of writers, everybody weighs in on it, but just as importantly is they all had, coming from much different backgrounds than I am and different ethnicities, they had much different viewpoints than I did. And really feeding off of that brought this play to where it was. And it was always a time period I was interested in, and the concept of dueling, the code de duelo, I was always kind of really interested in that and how the sort of toxic masculinity of that time period, you can really draw a straight line to here.
Sure.
And, you know, the truth of it is someone challenges you to do a duel, it just reminded me of being in, like, you know, in New Hampshire in fifth grade, and it was like, hey, you're going to get into a fight with this kid tomorrow after school. and how terrified you are, and you can't run away because you'll be, you know, ostracized. And you show up, and you get into a fight, and you almost piss your pants, and then you get in a lucky shot, and the kid's nose bleeds, and it stops, and then you're friends, and it's that huge relief. But how messed up that is, and how that continues to amplify as a man throughout your life. So taking that sort of emotion and applying it to the dueling really was just fascinating to me. And then the characters popping, which I tonally wanted a different thing than I'd ever written. And then, again, like working with the Temblers, the theme then really came out, and the theme informed what the play is today. And then working with Joe Bonney, who's a amazing director from New York. I've worked with her on two other plays as our third collaboration. And just having, as I think in all good art, but especially with theater, you just surround yourself with people who are really smart, have really good viewpoints. They don't try to make the play something that they would do, but they see your intent, they respect your intent, and they just offer a collaborative vibe and input, and everyone work together. I mean, I was blessed with this whole process.
It's wonderful.
Dream cast, the designers are out of this world, and it's really, really hard to do a play of this scale in L.A. What we did here was, the sort of the Equity Waiver 99-seat theater,
sure,
which Jen and I primarily work in, which I adore.
Yeah, me too.
And then there's, the Geffen, the CTG model, which they do beautiful work. And we're sort of somewhere in the middle. We did a lot of fundraising. We worked with, working with LATC on their, great facility and trying to create something that bridges that gap to be, an artistic experience, experiment in terms of the scene and all that stuff. So we really, really went for it. And it was just, it was very bold, and we're so happy with the results.
It's wonderful.
That came.
Yeah. Wait, now, where is it at?
It's at the Los Angeles Theater Center, which is in downtown.
Oh, okay. Oh, it is. Okay.
Which, by the way, man,
which is gorgeous.
Downtown, first of all, the facility is great. Downtown is just amazing. If you don't usually go down there, with, unfortunately, a lot of people don't, it's incredible. The energy there, the chaos, the restaurants, the bars. I mean, it's
really
fucking
off.
Amazing.
Yeah.
You feel like you're either in New York City in the 90s or you're on the set of Blade Runner. One of the two.
Sometimes both.
Right.
Depending on which corner you turn. Both exist at once down there. It's just what street you're on.
Yeah, it's true.
It goes from enchanting to scary to enchanting to scary, and you just kind of keep walking and driving through it.
Yeah, and we're feeding off that energy, and sort of the last piece of the puzzle was sort of, this play has been sitting in my drawer for a long time, and we've been workshopping it, and Joe, the director, I went out in 2013 and did a play with her that I was in, and we did really well with it, and while I was there, I gave her some other stuff, and she read this one, and she's like, I love this, let's do it. So as we've been developing it, zeroing in on the theme and just heightening it and sharpening it, last November, the country changed quite a bit. And it's been really interesting how much of the theme of the play is resonating with that. Part of it unintentionally, because we were dealing with toxic masculinity and a lot of those themes.
Sure.
And then
now we have toxic masculinity.
Well, it's really interesting, because there's some lines in the play that get a huge laugh, and when they were conceived, it was like they were just sort of pushing the plot. And now that there are these ironic cues, it's like people are extrapolating a lot of deeper meaning out of the play, which is great, as thinking that it's a more relevant contemporary take on these issues when it wasn't initially conceived in that. I mean, I think when you tap into something like universal, hopefully it will resonate on a specific level. But it's been really interesting. I've never been involved in a play that felt like it was really having a conversation with the audience cathartically about a lot of the shit that just gives us a headache every morning.
Yeah, but that's so important right now, and we need that so much right now. I was just talking to my last guest, who's on Sci-Fi's The Expanse, about the same thing, about how sometimes genres like sci-fi and fantasy allow you to deal with sociopolitical issues, but they're taken far enough away from the real world that they're not so messagey. And certainly looking at something that's done in a time period like your play.
Yeah, I think it's a similar thing.
And going back and thinking, oh, God, remember back then when we acted like that? Oh, wait.
Exactly.
I just saw that on the
news
this morning.
Look how arcane they are, right? Archaic things were back then, and how little things some of them has changed.
And you can do it without shoving a message down someone's throat.
Yeah.
Whereas
if
you set a play in today, and there were references to our politics right now, it would be so obvious that it was trying to be messagey.
Well, look, man, I have so mixed feelings about that because on one hand, if you really have a play that has a distinct message,
you should do it. I agree.
But then at the same time, like, who goes to plays? I mean, most people who go to theater are not necessarily are people who are pretty woke in general. You know,
it's true.
So,
but they're also kind of jaded sometimes to all of that stuff being put in a play. So you kind of have to do it in a creative, artistic way.
You have to do it in a creative, artistic way. And I think that the goal should then be know your audience and then try to make it a little more complex.
Yeah.
And you know, inspire, just make people think and start a conversation. But yeah, it's a tricky thing. It's a tricky thing.
So what is the difference are you in part producer of it?
Well, my theater, the Temblers, this initiative of which I'm a part of, are producing it with LATC.
Okay.
So as sort of a collective group, we have more say in it. Sometimes that's great. Sometimes it's a huge pain in the ass than you would in an ordinary play where you're just the writer. And you know, it's a deep bench of talent that the Temblers are, and everyone's sort of kicking ass at it. This is our first play. We're learning a lot from it.
It's wonderful.
And learning a lot that we'll do different next time, a lot of stuff that worked, a lot of stuff we lucked out on. But, I mean, the end product is we're all really blown away about how great it came out and really excited to just apply a lot of the stuff we learned out of this. But more importantly, we run for, you know, 3 more weekends, and then we just, you know, we want to fill the house because it's a really good time.
It's fantastic. What is the difference from a producing standpoint in filling a house that's a 99 seat or less and filling one that's bigger? I mean, the LATC theater, the first thing I thought was, oh my God, it's huge.
You know, that's a really good point, and that was one of our biggest lessons you learned. Now, at a certain budget level, 99 seats is a very sustainable amount.
Absolutely.
With minimal advertising.
Right.
We have a lot of good friends who work in the larger theaters, and maybe half of their budget goes into marketing.
Sure.
To fill, get asses in those seats.
Yeah.
So our money really is on the stage. And we have had, our houses have fluctuated. We've had unbelievable houses. And we've been really lucky. I mean, we've had more people typically than would go to a 99-seat theater. But nonetheless, it's 240 seats. That's a lot. And, you know, what happens in L.A. is the word of mouth spreads, and you get that critical mass. And as we are finding the second weekend, starting to fill up more and more seats. But it's a huge, huge challenge.
It is.
Because you're not spending, you don't have a $50,000 ad buy. You know, you're doing, you know, social media, and you're doing word of mouth.
I think if you're producing something independently, even if it's a group of people that are all independent, 99 seats is about the highest you can go with ease.
Yeah.
Until it starts to become a struggle to fill.
Well, and then
houses.
Even, you know, when
we
do plays.
Well, CTG and the Geffen, they all have subscription
base. Yeah.
That's what really drives their audience,
yeah.
I think. So it is hard, you know. And it's downtown. It's new. And,
yeah,
we're
pushing a lot. We don't, the Temblor brand, hopefully people see this and then they see, you know, what it's capable of. But, you know, you do a play at Rogue Machine and you have all the plays that went before you and you have people who are just, they get the brand and they'll go. But we're sort of starting from scratch here. And, I mean, that's been a challenge. Fortunately, a lot of great support. People have gone on. I mean, this play has gotten more press than any play I've ever done in L.A.
Isn't that wonderful?
A lot of that is Amy Brenneman, who's, like, awesome.
It was amazing.
Kicked ass.
Yes, it was absolutely amazing. Sure.
But we've been, you know, there's people seem really interested in just the story of how it got there and beyond that. And, like, again, you know, one of the silver linings of having a big cast is that they put the word out. We have a very motivated cast. They've all been fantastic.
That's great. And how big is your cast?
It's 10 people.
Oh, my God, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I miss big casts. Well, at the 99-seat level, right? I mean, 6 is a lot. 4 is better. Well, 2 is preferred.
And it's not even whether or not your space can handle it. It's now becoming with this whole equity.
Yes. Thing. Oh, God, yes.
The madness is sort of what that goes. Now, and again, this was the first play I ever wrote where I was like, I don't give a fuck how much it costs. I'm just going to write what I want.
Good for you.
And but that's also really challenging because then you have to start paying for it. And our costume designer, Stephanie Curly Schwartz, is a good friend of ours, is like, you realize there's 10 costumes and they change. I'm like, I just don't think about that.
Right,
stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's, you know.
That kind of goes against your, come on over and I'll give you a beer and you can just sit on the couch.
Oh, yeah, totally.
That's where you kind of became more like Jennifer there because you had to make sure the costumes all looked great.
Party. Well, when it comes to that stuff, I'm a pain in the ass, but if you go to my house, you can just relax.
That's fantastic. Jen, Irish accent, hard?
So hard.
It's hard, right?
Well, I'm not great at accents to begin with.
Okay.
But
you should go to the play just to see or hear Jen's accent.
Right.
It's working out now, but it took me a little bit to get. So
I don't know why it's tough, but I'm Irish and it's tough.
Well, I think I'm sure it took me a while just to like go for it and risk
that's
sounding stupid.
Yes.
And then you can pull back. I think that was the big moment when I realized. I was like, okay, I just have to do it. Like
the hardest thing about it is it's very sing-songy,
mm-hmm.
and it's very lilty. So you sort of have to almost say things and sing them at the same time.
Right.
And oftentimes you have to almost kind of put a question mark on the end of sentences. I mean, it really is a beguiling accent for a beguiling people, and I say that as one of them. But it's you kind of have to get into that vibe. Are you Irish?
No.
Okay.
Welsh and English.
Oh, well, you know.
Might be Irish. You said close. You don't know everything, so maybe.
I don't know everything.
Yeah. Nobody really
we
knows.
We want to do that DNA test where you like.
You should do it. Yeah. Where they no, but I want to. Where they swab you.
Yeah. Well, they don't do it. They don't like come to your house and swab you. They give you like a swab.
Well, yeah, but they give you a swab and you swab.
I think it would be cost prohibitive if they did like a house call.
Wouldn't that be great? Yeah. Like Publishers Clearing House. They come with a giant swab and a sign. You have won one swab, and then you have to stand there and let them do it. But you haven't done that yet? You're Italian, John.
I'm Italian, and then my mother's side is a variety of things.
Okay. Probably
French,
Irish.
Canadian, and yeah, I mean, they came down from Canada, some of them, and then they come from Rhode Island, and I'm not entirely sure. Mm-hmm. My grandfather used to tell tall tales, so we're not entirely sure what it is.
Oh, yeah, he was probably Irish. It seems like everybody's got a little Irish in them somewhere.
He used to joke they were Indian, which all white people want to say they're Indian.
Yeah.
It's just sort of like
in certain parts of the country.
Well, I'm not sure if everyone is.
In other parts of the country, they're horrified at the idea.
Oh, is that right?
I had a friend who was in Montana, and apparently up there you don't want to claim that you are because they're so close to so many reservations. And she was very shocked to see when she came down here. Everybody's like, oh, yeah, I'm a 185th. And everybody wants to be here because here our native tribes are so cool. They have beautiful casinos and cool commercials.
Yeah, I think it'd be super cool, but I don't want to take on someone else's identity.
That's true, though. I never heard people like claim that until I moved to California. Growing up, it was not something you heard.
Yeah. But I feel a little gypped because my mom's from Kentucky, and how can you be Irish and from Kentucky and not have some Cherokee in you? But I'm pretty sure we don't. Her explanation was, well, we're river people, and actually she used the words river trash, and the natives knew better than to come down to the river where the trash was. So that was, you know, well, the Irish sense of humor about ourselves, right?
You should swab, and let's
swab, and we'll see. What if there's some Cherokee in there?
I mean, that'd be kind of cool. I don't know if I don't think you get anything out of that, but...
Just gratification, right? It's just fun. It's just fun to know, I think.
You know, Matt, when I was in college, when I was in high school, I was being lazy ass, and I didn't fill out my application for college in time, and my mother filled it out for me. For SATs.
Okay.
So my mother filled it out, and I don't know why she did this. As a joke, she checked off Native American, because my grandfather used to always say that joke. I took the SATs, and I got called to the office of my guidance counselor. They're like, based on your SAT scores, you have a full boat to Stanford. The SAT scores along with your Native American heritage. And I was like, what are you talking about? And they're like, well, in your form, you fill this out. So I had scholarships to two schools, which obviously I couldn't take because it was a joke.
They make you prove it at some point.
Well, of course, as they
should. You have to be on the Dawson rolls or something, right?
As they should. But I was like, Mom, what is this? And she was like, oh, my God, I can't believe that happened. It was pretty funny. It was a good family joke.
Oh, with a tall tale from Grandpa.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, isn't that great? I had a hard time at the time getting into a school, even with great grades and a lot of theater accolades, because it was, especially in California, it was at that time when they didn't want to take people from your own state. They wanted... I got accepted to everywhere, NYU, Northwestern, places I didn't even apply, they asked me to apply, but I couldn't get into UCLA.
Really?
So, who knows?
Yeah, it's...
I went to the state school. I went to Long Beach State because their theater department was better than UCI.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, dude, I can't. We got two kids, man. The way prices of colleges, it's just, it's insane.
It's crazy, right? Even the community colleges now are so much more expensive.
Well,
it used to be like $50 a semester. And
the private schools here
cost
more than my college did.
Yeah.
Way more.
Yeah.
I don't know how people do it. I don't know.
I don't know. Your kids go to public school?
Well, one's two, so he doesn't really do anything.
Oh,
he's lazy ass. He just sits around. Shit.
He's pure eat carrots and.
Yeah. No, I mean he eats real food, but he doesn't really.
Well, he goes to little preschool.
Oh, that's right. He goes
two mornings a week.
Wait, okay,
whatever.
Fancy little preschool.
It's like one of these cute little like LA schools where first of all you're not allowed to put any like they can't have a shirt with like any designs on it, from, like a movie or something.
Any characters? Like words.
Logos or anything. It's
like
crazy.
Logos.
Why are they filming all the time for some reality show
don't
you don't know about?
No, they don't want the boys to like want to be superheroes, and they don't want the girls to want to like automatically be princesses.
It's a very nice school, but there's so much hippie.
There's lots
California
of
California bullshit. Out
that's
here.
That's really weird.
But I pick him up today, and he's covered head to toe in chalk. They like dumped multicolored chalk on him, and he's like,
etch a logo into it?
No,
so
he didn't.
Like
but
something?
I was like, you can't have logos, but you can like paint the kids.
You know, it's my best friend and her husband have their daughter, who's like my niece, in a private school in Laguna, and I feel the same way. Maybe that's my New England coming out.
Yeah.
She's always like, you know what she said today? And I'm like, get her out of that school. Put her in a public school. Get her out of that school. Because it's, you know, it's all, you're right. It's a super, super, I mean, I love hugging trees, but it's like, you know, people with beards are bad and like, you know, weird. I did a photo shoot and they wanted to take a picture in my hometown of Huntington Beach on the pier. So I asked my best friend to come down and be in the photo for this peace movement. I started this whole story about the peace movement. Anyway, she brought her family down. And afterwards, she was talking to her daughter, and her daughter said, how come you didn't take more pictures? And she said, well, I was just supposed to be in that one picture with Sheena, and that was it. And she said, good, because modeling is bad. And I'm like, first of all, I am not a model. Secondly, you got to get her out of that school. Because it's a lot of, like, it's almost like ultra-conservative on the other end. It's weird.
It can be constrictive.
Set of weird beliefs.
No, but I mean, I'll say our daughter, who's 12, who went through she's the smartest kid I've ever met. I mean, she is, like, amazing in the sense that she has that enlightenment that you get in California that you certainly don't get in New Hampshire and probably Dallas. And I mean, I'm just always so blown away about how courteous, how much she empathizes with everyone.
It's beautiful.
And she's really on a crusade to, I mean, she says when she grows up, she wants to be a humanitarian humanist and a musical theater artist.
Oh.
But that's all the product of, you know, growing up in like this really cool, diverse environment.
No, it's great
where
here.
You get
I agree.
That.
It's great here.
But it's also
think.
Crazy. I mean, look, man, it's like me. I grew up in a town where it's like that's the school you go to. That's just it.
Sure.
And the good or bad, that's all you have to worry about. But our parents definitely didn't have to stress about that. Whereas us, like, traffic, real estate, and schools are the three things that make you want to blow your head off every day.
But then look at the beautiful thing you get out there. You guys are wonderful. Will you come back and we'll do this again? I would love it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. Bring some of your cast if you want.
Yeah.
Where can people find out about the show online?
Sure. The website to buy tickets is thelatc.org, and the play is called Rules of Seconds. And there's a code. If you use the code RULES, RULES, you get 20% off for the next 2 weekends.
Do it. And where can people find you and Jennifer both online, John?
Facebook and stuff like that, I guess.
Yeah, John, you're on Twitter.
Oh, yeah, I'm on Twitter. Oh,
Jennifer, you're not. I tried to stalk you on Twitter.
No, I'm on Instagram and Facebook.
Jen doesn't really...
I'm not great at the social media.
Do it.
She likes looking at other people's stuff, but she doesn't really like
it. I just don't understand how it all works.
Do it, people. If you missed those links, SheenaMetalExperience.com, LATalkRadio.com, send me an email. And I will gladly forward those links to you. I'm on social media everywhere at Sheena Metal. And my new movement of peace, love, kindness, and unity, it's called I Am Raising the Vibration of the Nation and the World. We're at IamRaisingTheVibration.com. It's the Sheena Metal Experience on LA Talk Radio. And you know what we do here, people. Every Monday through Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time, we rip the veil off the human sideshow and expose those big old homo sapiens at their most bizarre and every day and always, of course, at their very most beautiful. And you know, it's my show, and that's true, my friends. What it really is, it's your experience. Thanks for listening. Have a great night. I'll see y'all tomorrow right here on LA Talk Radio.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.